Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday morning. It's March 13th. We've got 33 degrees here and kind of a rainy mix on the, and 37 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, that is the beginnings of our winter storm that is developing out there for us this morning. Of course, this is the early stages, but we're starting to squeeze out a little precipitation. Again, a little rain, snow mix showing up for now, but as we go throughout the day, we are expecting that to turn over, especially by this afternoon into the evening hours, to the potential of some heavy snow as you get up toward Park City. In fact, we're probably looking at about, all said and done by tomorrow morning, about 4 to 8 inches of snow around the Park City area. As you get into Heber Valley, we'll likely hang on to some of that rain or rain snow mix throughout the first half of the day. And then as we get into the afternoon and evening hours, we'll see that transition over to all snow there. But we could also pick up about 1 to 3 inches of snow as that system moves through later this evening and tonight with the main moisture there. So a pretty active afternoon and evening. And at the same time, as we go throughout this afternoon, because this system is going to be pretty dynamic, it's going to have the chance of possibly producing a couple of isolated rumbles of thunder. So we could also hear some rumbles of thunder and maybe a few flashes of lightning this afternoon before that cold air really starts to pour in and we switch it all over to snow tonight. Now, to go into your Friday, we could wake up to a few scattered snow showers around, and that chance will be there with us throughout the day tomorrow. But again, the best chance of that is going to be during the first few hours of the morning there on your Friday. Otherwise, we'll call it partly cloudy skies for your Friday afternoon. Temperatures, though, only probably warming up to around 30 degrees in Park City, and will likely stay in the mid to upper 30s for highs as you get towards the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your weekend, we're not done with the active weather. In fact, we've got a quick moving storm system that's going to move in Friday night into Saturday. That's going to bring another round of potential accumulating snow across the area. Looks like right now that one could be another 4 to 8 inches for places like Park City, with the potential 1 to 3 additional inches for the Heber Valley as we go throughout your Saturday. So keep in mind, a colder storm, that means that a better chance of that one being snow for everyone from start to finish. It's not going to have as much moisture, but again, could definitely be impactful across the area. Now, as we get into your Sunday, we finally dry things out briefly, and so we get a nice little break with partly cloudy skies on your Sunday. Temperatures will be on the frigid side. We'll kick off our Sunday with temperatures in the upper teens, the low 20s there in both the Heber Valley and in Park City, with high temperatures as we go throughout your Sunday in the mid 40s there in Park City, and highs around 50 in the Heber Valley. So those south winds will start to warm us back up again, but that's ahead of our next storm system. Where have you heard me say that before? But looks like for our St. Patrick's Day, if you're making plans, I'll call it mostly dry right now across most areas here as we go into your Monday, with temperatures on the mild side, mid-40s for highs in Park City and highs in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. But we will be seeing those clouds on the increase. And yes, more snow, Leslie, as we get towards next Tuesday. So yeah, the active weather seems to be here for a while now.
Okay. Thank you, Cedric.
Thank you.
And taking a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Trent. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we're going to see, I mean, the weather report was great. We're going to definitely see snowfall there across northern Utah. It looks like a great storm for us. And the cold front, like we just heard, is going to come around the dinner hour. We'll see a nice pulse and good shot of snow there. You know, all said and done, the mountains could see 1 to 3 feet of new snow, depending on just, you know, where the storm totals land. We'll see. Yesterday, the last day of like a fake spring, in a sense, it was very beautiful out in the mountains. The winds were elevated and bothersome. I was out yesterday, and we really didn't get many avalanche observations, which is a good thing, over the past few days. There was a couple avalanches reported from back when we had the storm. What was that? About a week ago, Friday. Our biggest concern today will be wind drifted snow. And currently those south winds are really moving right now up at upper elevations, along up, you know, ridge lines. We're 10 to 25 miles per hour gusting 30 and 40 across that terrain. So that strong wind has been blown for the past 24 hours, and it's created hard, stiff slabs of windblown snow. And then, you know, today we're going to see heavy snowfall, strong wind. It's likely going to create new soft slabs of wind-drifted snow. So there's going to be that problem out there today. Our next avalanche problem will be our new snow. As that new snow stacks up, Right about when it gets to 6 inches, you can see that snowfall or that snow become reactive. Now the snow can fail within its own like density, or it could break down to an old snow surface. So really the new snow avalanche problem today will depend on how much snow we get, how fast we get it, and we'll see if it stacks up. And then finally, our persistent weak layer, it's still here. I know we're so tired of hearing about it over and over and over, but we do still have some weak faceted snow in our snowpack at the mid and upper elevations, especially on slopes that are shaded or the north side of the compass there. So, you know, in summary today, the avalanche danger with heavy snowfall and strong winds will quickly rise. Across that upper elevation terrain, you'll find a considerable avalanche danger for wind drifted snow. Out of the wind, really it's a moderate avalanche danger out there for new snow avalanches. So that's sort of what we're looking at for the next, for today. But remember, as the storm snow stacks up today and into tomorrow, we're likely going to see that avalanche danger rise. And it could stay elevated through the weekend as well.
Okay. Hey, I'm looking at the video there online that you posted about checking out the snowpack.
Yeah.
You've got a rope around your waist. What's that about?
Well, I wanted to see, we've been talking about repeater avalanche zones all year, and I wanted to see what the snowpack looked like in a spot that I know had avalanche. So that's in Day's Fork up at Day's Draw, and that's a steep 38 degree slope, and I went right into the starting zone of that pass, and so I was belayed into the slope to make sure that if it did accidentally avalanche on me, that I wouldn't go for the ride.
Ooh, okay. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you could be dangerous though, too. Cutting you.
I had the harness on.
Oh, okay.
So I was in a climbing harness and tied in and I was on belay.
All
and really, I just wanted to dig down and see if we still had faceted snow out there in those repeater zones. And the video clearly shows that we're not out of the woods yet this winter for those facets.
All right. Trent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Trent Meisenheimer with Utah Avalanche Center. Stay tuned. In just a minute here, we'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Chris Robinson. Later on, Swanner Nature Preserve and Eco Center Director of Exhibits and Visitor Experience Hunter Klingensmith with details on some upcoming events. And finally, Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang with a preview of some upcoming screenings. And just so you all know, Summit County and Park City Film are financial supporters of this radio station. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include Nate Pedersen, historian, librarian, and co-author of the new book, Pseudoscience, An Amusing History of Crackpot Ideas and Why We Love Them. Then University of Utah physics professor George Cassidy talks about the history of particle physics. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, of course, heard every Thursday at 9 a.m. The Summit County Council met yesterday. On the phone with a recap, I have County Council Member Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with yesterday's housing discussion that was held before the council went into closed session to discuss property acquisition. The council decided on an affordable housing goal, 1,500 affordable units. So what's the timeline for that?
Over the next 10 years.
Okay. Now, when Park City set its goal of building 800 affordable units over 10 years, it was to maintain 12% of the employees living within city boundaries. Jeff Jones, Housing and Economic Development Director, estimates that 6,000 units are needed to maintain Summit County's ratio of 36% of workers living within our boundaries. And as he told us on Tuesday, while the population of Summit County drops, the number of jobs increases every year. That basically means businesses will have a more difficult time to pay their employees to make it worth their while to commute. And as a result, we would see a bunch more traffic. So how did the council come up with that 1,500 unit number?
Well, Jeff Jones, 6,000 number is all kinds of housing, and it includes 2,200 additional homes due to the second home nature or vacant housing, as Jeff calls it. And so really that's the market rate and affordable. When you dive into the numbers, it's more like maybe 1,500 to 2,000 of affordable, which I'm defining as the various percentages of AMI up to 120%, what we call attainable housing. And so that 6,000 number includes a lot of market housing that, that the marketplace would provide. And as I said, a third of it is, it's been grossed up by a third due to the second homes. So I can't say that our 1,500 number is scientifically derived, but we felt like that was a good number to deal with some 1,600 units of backlog that we have, as well as going forward. It's not a perfect number, but it's a great start.
All right, so where do we put those 1,500 units?
Well, that 1,500 was the counting for that would start after, it doesn't take into account what might happen at Dakota Pacific nor at Klein-Dolly. I want to state that up front. So those, they would not be counted against the 1,500 goal. There are various proposals in the basin that are talked about at Silver Creek, not Village, but the one where US 40 comes into I-80, redeveloping the factory outlets, and a few other locations. And then, of course, there's the whole rest of the county. But that remains to be seen. You know, finding the proper place for them is always challenging.
So I guess putting the word out, then what do you want developers to know about that 1,500 number? Because, I mean, you had said that again, it's not included the Klein-Dolly or Dakota Pacific, but it shouldn't also be taken as a green light to redevelop the Junction Commons or the outlets.
Well, that was one of the process conundrums we have because, as Peter Barnes, our community development director, pointed out, that let's say that there is this 1,500 unit goal, but most of the properties are zoned something else. You know, they're zoned rural residential, or they're zoned something that doesn't accommodate denser housing. And so these developers could spend lots of months or years and tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars saying, oh, well, the county signaled this, we ought to go for broke on this piece of property, only to find out the county doesn't want it there. So we're trying to figure, one of the next steps is for the staff to come back to us with the process on how that might work, because we could have a lot of frustrated landowners and developers spending lots of effort only to come up short in the end because it would require a rezone or something.
You're right.
Most of these parcels, you know, we have a community commercial zone that will allow multifamily. We don't even have a zone right now that will allow a duplex in a residential zone. We have 1 to 20. That's it. That's our most dense zone.
All right.
That's a single family home.
Yeah. So I guess what does this then do to that housing authority plan? I mean, are you going to have to adopt bylaws soon, or is that being tabled while the staff drafts this plan?
We decided to model the housing authority off a similar structure that we used with High Valley Transit, which would have 5 board members, 3 of whom would be county council members, and 2 would be selected by the council to hopefully bring outside expertise. And that gave the council more comfort that we wouldn't spawn some kind of an entity that might get ahead of their skis, so to speak. And so there still needs to be drafting of the bylaws and kind of a plan, and that's part of what the staff's assignment is as well.
So this seems like the most concrete progress towards an affordable housing plan ever. What's taken so long?
Oh, that's a good question, Leslie. I think I keep saying that we've been schizophrenic. You know, we say we want affordable housing, but then we don't. Or how much do we need? And we get hamstrung because we don't have a plan. And so we think we want it, but then we don't act. And I think it's just a confluence of a lot of factors where the time is right to do it. There's been outside influences with the moderate income housing plan requirements the state's imposed, and we're at least I am, I think the rest of council are keenly aware of the trends that are making our area less affordable. That gap is widening, and the hollowing out of our middle class workforce and citizenry. And I just think the timing was good. Plus, we did, even though you think, well, how in 4 hours can that make a difference? But we did dedicate some time with a good facilitator that also helped push it over the edge.
Okay. And again, a heads up to those that, you know, we could call NIMBYs, not in my backyard, because it sounds like there will be changes afoot here as we have to look at rezoning parcels as part of the, I guess, the general plan overhaul, huh?
Well, I don't think we're going to do an overall rezone. We talked, Dave Thomas, our chief civil deputy county attorney, talked about we could create an affordable zone that would be 100%, for example, affordable housing, that that's all it was, and that parties could seek to it. Right now, we have the inclusionary zoning, where if you want to build something, you've got to build whatever density you want to build a market. You've got to build 20% more on top of that of affordable. But I don't think we're going to go around and rezone a lot of properties in a vacuum. We may consider this idea that David had, but that's unknown too. But it was an interesting idea. That would then, at least for me, it was interesting. It would allow there to be a zone to which parties could apply that would be purely for this. But anyway, we're not going to rezone the whole county, I don't believe.
Yeah, so we're throwing out the notion of integrating affordable homes with market rate homes, it sounds like, with this all affordable housing zone.
Well, the all affordable housing zone, I don't know. I would say that it's integrated. Let's say you have a parcel that, and say we had that zone, and that 100% of the units be affordable. That doesn't sound very integrated. It would be a project would be affordable housing. Now, from the outside, and the quality of the units, it might be indistinguishable from a market, but they wouldn't have interspersed among them market units, probably.
Well, but
I'm just speculating.
Well, I'm just saying that we worked very hard and passed. I know the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission talked about this for months in terms of what, you know, the Discovery property, the Silver Creek Village. It was like, it was important that the affordable housing wasn't, you know, the ghetto.
Right. And I don't think any of us want a ghetto. I don't know how to reconcile your use of the term integration and my use of the term 100% affordable housing in a given project if we had such a zone. And I don't want to get off on that tangent because it was just an idea.
All right.
You know, that one of our attorneys threw out.
Coming up on Friday, a joint meeting with the Park City Council. You'll hear about recycling operations in Summit County. So what's going on behind the scenes here?
Well, behind the scenes, you know, Recycle Utah has, I guess they're not behind the scenes, but in the front of the scene, Recycle Utah has been asked by Park City to vacate their Munchkin location, and they have been doing a lot of analysis and have hired a consultant to come up with a plan what they think ought to happen with solid waste and recycling in our county. And we're going to hear on tomorrow, I guess, from Tim Loveday, his state of the recycling world. And I think Recycle Utah has been a good catalyst to help us focus on really, what is our strategy going forward? We have landfills with finite lives on which, in my opinion, or for which we're charging low tipping fees, sort of like we're using up our a finite supply, and the replacement cost of the next iteration of landfill space will be exponentially higher and more difficult and need to divert. And We need to come together with a more strategic way of looking at it. I think that's what I'm advocating for, and including our good partner, Recycle Utah, in it.
Okay. Finally, wanted to get your reaction to the legislature's action, like 3 minutes before this year's session ended, House Bill 356, which requires that Summit County district the council seats. Anything being done behind the scenes to fix this, given that residents did vote to have these at-large seats, like, what, back in 2006 or something?
Yeah. The main thing that is really frustrating about that House Bill 356 is that it was put forward by, again, a legislator who has nothing to do with Summit County, but behind the scenes supported by some legislators who do have things to do with Summit County, and a group of unknown operatives, I'm going to call them, without any real engagement with the citizenry or the leadership of the county. And I believe it passed with veto-proof majorities. And I don't know that we have the clout anyway to upend, to get a veto. It has some unintended consequences for other counties that are not 100% districted in their selection of their council members. And it's unfortunate that, and then it's demonstrative a little bit of how little power we have at the legislature, where despite a lot of effort at the 11th hour, something can be added to a list and just crammed through and hearings canceled where we might have had a chance to at least give an opinion, leading up to the last day. So it's indicative, I think, of process problems and weakness that we have at the legislature.
Yeah, so nothing could be brought back in an interim session then?
No, I think that's the only hope of making any change. I don't see it being vetoed, and so that would be the next step.
All right, and then I saw that Governor Cox signed Senate Bill 26. This basically makes amendments to the HDRZ Act, and I guess formalizes the revised development agreement between Summit County and Dakota Pacific. So what will the effect of this bill be, do you think?
It's hard to say. I think the overall takeaway from all of these different machinations, I'll call them, is that Dakota is here to stay. You have preliminary municipality, you have, these different, the House Bill, Senate Bill 26. There's just lots of layers to this onion. I don't know if that will be invoked. I don't know whether we're having a referendum, on it. There's just a lot of iterations, but it seems to me that most of them point toward there'll be a project on Dakota's property.
Okay, Chris, I'm out of time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Summit County Council Member Chris Robinson. There's a lot happening at Swanner Preserve and Nature Center. In the studio with a rundown of upcoming events, I have the Director of Exhibits and Visitor Experience, Hunter Klingensmith. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So we've got the Amazing Butterflies exhibit still up?
We do have it still up. It's here through May 4th, and we actually have a free day on Friday. So if you haven't had a chance to see it and maybe cost is a barrier to you, Friday is a great time to come. We're open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it's totally free.
Okay. What are people going to see?
So the exhibit is all about butterflies. We do not have live butterflies. We have some pinned specimens of butterflies, but the main theme of the maze is learning about a butterfly's life cycle and the challenges that it faces along the way, and the other insects and animals that kind of help it through that journey. So as you make your way through the maze, there are a variety of challenges. You have to feed the caterpillars. You have to move like a caterpillar. There are opportunities to dress up like a butterfly. The exhibit is designed for ages 3 to 12, but has lots of great information. I've learned some really cool things. I learned that there's actually a caterpillar that secretes a liquid that has sugars and amino acids, and ants eat that and then protect the caterpillars. So those caterpillars are actually 4 to 12 times more successful in surviving through their pupal stage.
Okay. And let's see, I think this evening as well as Friday night from 8 to 9:30, the March Moonlight Snowshoe Tours full moon, absolutely gorgeous, but do you have snow to snowshoe on?
This is a great question. We've been doing a bit of scrambling this week. So tonight's tour, we actually did some changing it up. So tonight's tour is taking place on the preserve, not on snowshoes. And then we do have an option for tomorrow night. It's still open on our website if anyone wants to sign up. We're actually going to go up Daly Canyon instead so that we can still snowshoe. And that'll be with me. We'll go at 8 p.m. So if you'd like to sign up for that, people can go to our website.
Okay. And then I guess a heads up that summer camp registration is opening or has opened?
Yep, it has not opened yet. It's the deadline for becoming a member to get early registration has passed. But if you are already a member and you want that early registration, you should have gotten an email from Catherine this week. If you did not get that, definitely reach out to her. It's catherine.veder@usu.edu. That's on our website. And then Sandhill Society registration, that's one of our membership levels, is this Friday, May 14th at 9 a.m. And then all of our other members, so family members, Kestrel, Warbler, are all Monday, March 17th at 9 a.m. And I recommend getting on right away and kind of knowing what camps you want to register. You can register multiple kids at a time, which is great about the way the Eventbrite system works. And then general registration opens Wednesday, March 19th at 9 a.m. And yet again, get on as early as possible because they fill really fast.
Yeah. Okay. They do sell out.
Yeah.
Is it just you just don't have more room for all of them?
Yeah. We are maxed out on both incapacity for both staff and space in the Eco Center for those programs. We do run a lot throughout the summer. There are half-day and full-day options. And then we also still have space in our Wild Explorers after-school programs, which happen on Tuesdays. They usually run for a month, so you would register your kid for that month of Tuesdays. So in April, the theme is Mountain Marvels, and that's Tuesday, April 1st, 8th, and 22nd. And then in May, we have Welcoming Wetlands, which should be really fun because May is such a cool time on the preserve. You get to get out and stomp around in the water and see lots of wildlife. And that one is May 6th, 13th, and 20th, and it's $60 per session for that program.
Okay. And let's see, when do we start to see some activity from the cranes?
Oh, we actually saw them this week. So on Tuesday night, I was leaving and I looked out the back door onto the back deck and there were two sandhill cranes standing right there on the back deck. So they are back and we are looking forward to them mating and laying eggs anytime now. Usually they have about a 30-day gestational period. And if they lay eggs again in the pond right outside of the Eco Center, which we're assuming that's the pair that lays there that was on the back deck, we will have the webcam focused on the nest and you can watch the whole process happen. Right now we have the webcam kind of panning between cranes we can find on the preserve and elk. You can just find that webcam live on our website anytime.
Okay. Well, and you're probably aware of the Big Bear Valley, the eagles, Jackie and Shadow. I mean, it's just like, right?
Oh my gosh, I know.
Take me away.
You get like so sucked into it. Sometimes I pull them up on my second computer screen and I can't get away from it.
I know. Okay. Let's see. What else?
We have one other webinar coming up. So on April 1st at 6 p.m., you can just register on our website. It's free. We're having a pika webinar. So those cute little furry high alpine creatures, they look a little bit like mice, but they have bigger ears and are a little bit larger. We're going to talk with Dr. Pika Joe, that's her nickname, Varner, who studies them in the LaSalle Mountains and actually studies their resiliency as the climate is changing. And they've found that these kind of isolated communities of them are actually doing pretty well. And so we're going to hear all about that. It's a good time for some hopeful messages. So we're really excited to hear from her. That'll be on April 1st at 6 p.m. And then we're planning a series of other adult education things. And then we also have our annual Earth Day cleanup. It's not actually on Earth Day. It's going to be on May 3rd from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. That should be up on our website for registration this week. And what we do is we clean up any trash and materials that are surrounding the preserve because a lot of the stormwater drainage in the surrounding area ends up on the preserve and then is in the ponds and impacts wildlife and the water quality. So we get out there. We've had over 200 people almost every year. And we'll have opportunity drawing with lots of fun things from local vendors. Usually Bartolo's does coffee and snacks for people who participate. So it's a really fun morning, and we appreciate all the help we can get with that. And then we're also doing some strategic planning right now. Right now we're doing focus groups, but we will have a community survey coming out sometime early summer. So look for that if you'd like to give some feedback on ways that you think Swanner can better serve our community, that you would like to connect with Swanner or with nature through Swanner. So lots of fun ways to get involved.
Okay. And then what are you working on for the next exhibit after May?
Oh, great question. So I'm in the process of signing a contract for a new exhibit next spring. However, we are going to design an in-house exhibit for the fall that's called the Wetland Supermarket. I actually haven't announced this yet, so this will be the first time. Wetlands are like the supermarkets of the natural world, and so we're going to, often when you go to children's museums, you see like a supermarket play exhibit, but this one will be all themed around wetlands. So resources that you find in a wetland that wildlife use in a wetland, over 80% of wildlife use a wetland at some point in their life cycle, so it'll be a fun opportunity to dress up, play, interact, and learn about the resources the wetlands provide.
Okay. Hunter, anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it. Just come see us. There's lots happening on the preserve now. It's spring. The elk are there. We have lots of migratory birds coming in. We're probably not going to be snowshoeing on the preserve anymore, but if you'd like to come for a Saturday nature walk, it's a great way to see the preserve.
Okay. Hunter Klingensmith with Swanner Nature Preserve. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Park City officials will consider approving a public financing request from Deer Valley Resort for its Snow Park Village project today. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has details.
The proposed tunnel would cross under State Route 224 to connect the Yarrow Doubletree Hotel property to Snow Creek Plaza, home of the market and a state liquor store. It's a heavy traffic area where jaywalkers are sometimes spotted, and the nearest crosswalk is a short walk away. If the council opts for a tunnel, estimates outlined in a staff report show the price tag could be well above $16 million. But that isn't the only option on the table. A cheaper alternative could be to install a high-intensity activated crosswalk, or HAWC, which is similar to what operates on Park Avenue in front of Fresh Market. A price estimate for a HAWC ranges from $500,000 to $800,000. Any improvement will require coordination with the Utah Department of Transportation, as Kearns Boulevard is a state-managed road. The council could also choose to not move forward with any pedestrian improvements. Park City voters approved a $15 million bond in 2007 to fund pedestrian projects around town. Over $4 million remains, and for years it's been envisioned to fund the Snow Creek Tunnel. In April 2024, the Park City Council delayed moving forward with the tunnel due to a pending application to redevelop the Doubletree Hotel. The developers working on that project had expressed a willingness to work with the city on the tunnel, but their proposal hit a snag last year when a majority of city planning commissioners said they weren't in favor of granting height exceptions for the development. The project is scheduled to return to the Planning Commission on March 26th. The Park City Council will discuss next steps for the tunnel at a public hearing Thursday. The agenda and a link to attend virtually can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Joining me now on the phone with a preview of some upcoming screenings at Jim Santee Auditorium is the Executive Director of Park City Film, Katie Wang. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start with tonight's screening, Maestra.
Yes, so Maestra is a really exciting documentary that we have been looking forward to bringing back to Park City for a while. It's about the only competition in the world for female conductors, which is called La Maestra. It's in Paris, and the story follows five competitors and their stories of survival, passion, and perseverance in, of course, the very male-dominated world of orchestral conducting. We'll have a post-film discussion with the director, Maggie Contreras, and we'll also have Utah Symphony assistant conductor, Jessica Rivero Altariba, and the Vice President of Artistic Planning, Carrie Smith, joining us after the film for a panel discussion. So super exciting to be able to highlight the great work that these women are doing, you know, around the world, and be able to, of course, connect with the Utah Symphony and what's going on here locally and elevate the female conductors and artists here in our own community. So this is part of our Raising Voices film series. I want to thank Park City Municipal and Park City Chamber for their support. Admission is free, and that's at 7 o'clock tonight.
So, again, one night only.
One night only, yes, exactly. So if you do want to see this great film, and I hope you do, please join us tonight. Then we've got some other great films, of course, coming up. Our weekend film is Nickel Boys. This is based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Colson Whitehead. And it's about the powerful friendship between two young African-American boys as they try to survive a brutal reform school in Florida. The film is honestly unlike anything I have ever seen. It is lyrical, it's poetic, it's devastating. It is a film that you will have so much to talk about and unpack long after the credits roll. I saw it at the Telluride Film Festival and people could not stop talking about this film. It was just, it kind of blew everyone away. So definitely one to put on the list if you are a cinephile and come see this amazing film this weekend. And that's Friday and Saturday at 7 o'clock and then again Sunday at 6. The next week, we are back with a film that premiered at the 2024 Sundance Film Festival called Every Little Thing. And this is a beautiful film about a woman in Los Angeles who rehabilitates injured hummingbirds. Her quest is to save every hummingbird in Los Angeles, which is a laudable goal, certainly. And her compassion and empathy just illustrates that grace can be found in the smallest acts of kindness. It is a film that will absolutely steal your heart. I love seeing it at Sundance. It's kind of stuck with me over the course of the year. So excited to be able to bring that back as we head into Earth Month and spring and celebrating rebirth and all of that. And then we're partnering with Park City Reads on the 27th of March, the Thursday, for a special presentation by Dr. Ned Hallowell. We hosted with Park City Reads a film last year called The Disruptors about people with ADHD. And it was wildly successful and really just revealed the need in our community for more information and support for people, students in particular, with ADHD. So we're really excited to be partnering with them to do this live presentation, so not a film. You'll actually be here in person to talk about the latest brain science in ADHD. Dr. Hallowell is a leading expert in ADHD. He actually has it himself. He's also dyslexic. And he'll also talk about strategies and lifestyle hacks to better manage and really thrive with this neurological difference. So registration is definitely, we highly recommend registration. It's a free event. We already have lots of people signed up. As I said, there's been a great deal of interest and Dr. Hallowell is amazing. So if you do wanna join us for that presentation, please register in advance because we wanna make sure that everyone gets a seat that wants to come for that. So that's on the 27th of March.
Okay, and then the final weekend of March is rock and roll.
Yes, and this is one of my favorite bands, so this is a little bit like something that's close to my heart. It's called Becoming Led Zeppelin. It is the first official documentary about Led Zeppelin, and it's really about the origins of this iconic group and their meteoric rise to fame. I had no idea. I mean, within a year's time, they basically went from 0 to 1,000. I mean, just incredible story of how they kind of exceeded the Beatles and fame and, you know, people coming to their concerts and all this kind of stuff. So just really a great celebration of music. I mean, so iconic for, you know, old people like me who grew up with it. And it certainly, you know, it resonates today with younger folks. So I think it kind of crosses generations there. We will have beer and wine available for purchase to celebrate that great film. And want to thank Bev and Ray Kent for helping us bring the film here to Park City. So we got a lot, very eclectic mix going on this month, but hopefully it'll something for everyone to enjoy and be excited about.
Okay, wanted to ask you, will you get Anora on the schedule? I mean, I'd never even heard of it until the Oscar nominees were announced.
We already showed it, actually.
Oh man, I missed it.
It's okay. so good. You should definitely see it. I saw it at the Telluride Film Festival, loved it. It's honestly one of my favorite films of the year. And we ended up showing it in, I think it was early January, late December timeframe. But yeah, I'm sorry, we've already brought that one. It's hard after the Academy Award, you wanna bring stuff back, but the way that we program, it's hard to get films back in a timely fashion. Yeah, but since we'd already shown it, that was what we won't bring back. But oh, fantastic film.
Darn it. Okay, well, my mistake.
Sorry about that.
All right, Katie, anything else you want to mention?
No, you can go to parkcityfilm.org, check out our calendar of upcoming events. We will have another series of free films in April during the spring break. So if you are here for the spring break, want to take advantage of that last week of skiing, we will be there for you, après-ski. But, you know, again, lots of great films coming up on the weekends. Those two special events tonight, of course, for Maestra, and then on the 27th with Dr. Ned Hallowell. It's always great if people register in advance for the free events, particularly with Dr. Hallowell. But, of course, if you have last-minute change of plans, please join us. We love to have you at the theater. Enjoy seeing everyone at the movies. Great films coming up. We'll be programming out through about beginning of June this year. So
okay, Katie, thanks.
Thank you.
As Park City Opera approaches its first anniversary, it's looking back on the 20 concerts the group produced over the last year. The company will celebrate St. Patrick's Day at Jordanelle State Park. Park City Opera is a team of three, two singers and a musician-composer. Co-founder and performer Liesl Wangerman says their performances are supplemented with talented local singers and musicians, including high school students.
Which has been really great because we can offer a lot of different perspectives on the repertoire that we program. Something that is so unique about art song repertoire is that it is really broad and diverse, and each singer can have a facet of this genre that they really love and are passionate about. And so the larger a team is, the more perspective can be offered in discussing and planning what we present to audiences.
The St. Patrick's Day performance will be a nod to Irish culture at the Hailstone Events Center at Jordanelle State Park.
It is a glass pavilion, and we'll be bringing in a piano and a couple of really, really talented singers to sing songs and arias that represent Irish heritage and culture.
Doors open at 6:30 p.m. with a reception sponsored by Park City Brewing before the performance starts at 7. The group will perform at the Meyer Gallery on Park City's Main Street April 26th. Then this summer, the company will stage its first full opera August 24th, The Barber of Seville. Tickets for that go on sale April 1st. A link for tickets and more information for the St. Patrick's performance is available online at kpcw.org. Well, with growing measles outbreaks in Texas and elsewhere across the country, health officials in the Wasatch Back say it's not too late to get vaccinated. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
At least two people have died of measles this year, a school-aged child in West Texas and an unvaccinated adult in New Mexico. They are the first reported deaths from the illness in the U.S. since 2015. Over 200 others in 12 states had been sickened as of March 6th, mostly children and mostly unvaccinated individuals. Measles is a highly contagious airborne disease with no treatment. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say if one person is infected, up to 9 out of 10 people nearby will catch it if they're not vaccinated. Wasatch County Health Department Executive Director Janelle Fitzgerald says the best defense against measles is vaccination. The measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is 97% effective at preventing the illness after two doses. The CDC says a community must be 95% vaccinated to stop measles from spreading, but the Wasatch Back falls short of that standard. According to Fitzgerald, for the 2023-24 school year, 89.9% of kindergartners had their MMR vaccines. That's slightly higher than in neighboring Summit County, where 87% of students started kindergarten with the vaccine. Vaccination data for the 2024-25 school year is expected to be published this spring by Utah's Department of Health and Human Services. Fitzgerald says Utahns can check that they're up to date on all their immunizations by visiting the state's docket website. Wasatch County residents can also call their primary care provider or the county health department to check their vaccine records. She says anyone can schedule an appointment to get the MMR vaccine at the Wasatch County Health Department. NPR reports an extra dose of the vaccine is also recommended for certain high-risk adults, including people working in healthcare and those who live or work closely with immunocompromised people. As of Wednesday, a spokesperson for the state health department said Utah had no reported cases of the measles. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And the owners of Park City's ski resorts unsuccessfully tried to get a tax break during this year's Utah legislative session. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that may have hiked residential taxes.
Deer Valley Resort and Talisker, Park City Mountain's main landlord, appealed for lower property values and therefore lower taxes from Summit County in 2023 and 24 and are in settlement talks. This year, Summit County Assessor Stephanie Paul was upset, as the deputy county manager put it, when she learned about a line item added to Senate Bill 295, sponsored by GOP Senator Dan McKay of Riverton. The assessor's job is to calculate the market value of every property, what they would sell for tax purposes. Paul claims an attorney representing both Deer Valley and Talisker asked for a few lines to strong-arm the county.
He absolutely asked for that language to be put in, and in multiple conversations has said, should a settlement agreement be reached, he would be willing to have it pulled.
Until March 3rd, four lines in McKay's bill may have altered a method of property appraisal called the income method, where assessors look at the income a property generates and use that to calculate its value. The exact effect of those lines wasn't clear to assessors like Paul, but she believes their primary purpose was to influence settlement talks. She says the Utah Association of Counties dubbed the four lines a, quote, poison pill in an otherwise unproblematic bill. A 1997 state audit says the income method is preferred for commercial properties. Utah's a non-disclosure state, meaning assessors don't always know how much properties sell for. So when it comes to market prices on commercial properties, Paul says income helps fill in the gaps.
Without this income information, without sales information on commercial, the assessors throughout the state feel that we are low on our commercial properties.
Paul has previously valued Talisker's land at about $662 million and Deer Valley's at $321 million. She couldn't quantify the exact amount they're disputing, but a tax break on properties that expensive could mean thousands in savings. Utah's property tax system is a zero-sum game, and taxing entities must collect the same amount of money each year unless they go through a public process to raise taxes. If they don't, residential tax bills can still go up or down year to year because property values change. What that means is when one person's property value goes up and their neighbor's doesn't, the first person's property taxes go up while the neighbor's taxes go down. Statewide, undervaluing commercial property has raised some residents' property taxes. Assessors call that a tax shift. A stark Summit County example is on Chalk Creek Road in northern Summit County. Residences there have become more valuable, but oil fields haven't kept pace. Now, nine households pay thousands in property taxes to maintain the road that oil companies were supposed to pay for. Something similar could happen across Summit County if resort property values don't increase as much as homes. Deer Valley and Talisker have yet to settle their Summit County tax appeals, and neither responded to KPCW's request for comment on McKay's bill last week. The senator also didn't respond to requests for comment during or after the legislative session, so the reason for the reversal is unclear. He did speak to it in the House Revenue and Taxation Committee.
We've removed that portion from the bill in the second substitute. So the second substitute doesn't deal with the income approach as it relates to property. We had two different opinions on how that should be done, and the what ended up winning out was the parties meeting and talking and coming up with some progress on their own, which, you know, makes a great policy when, you know, you got everybody negotiating and they come up with a solution that potentially is going to deal with it. The language that was in the bill really just mirrored language that was in a tax commission decision related to the issue.
Paul says she and other assessors want to fix the residential commercial imbalance, a process she terms equalization. She thanked Senator McKay at the March 3rd committee meeting for his past efforts to increase real estate disclosures and for removing the ski resort line item.
We have been in forward motion with our taxpayer and hoping to settle quickly as we can. We still have a little bit of a spread in our values, but we hope to continue working forward with that and reaching an agreement that we can both feel good about.
Paul declined to share the name of the attorney representing Deer Valley and Talisker in their appeal. KPCW was unable to independently identify the lawyer. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.